Yeah, I grew up, I was born, actually born, and I grew up for the first 10 years of my life behind what is now the bakery on Brustraat 28. Brustraat 28 and the bakery produces great, great stuff. We enjoy it every time we come in. But years and years ago, Brustraat 28 was a herenmodel Pesepot. Pesepot was my dad, my father. And for the first 10 years we lived together, he had a radio hidden in a compartment in front of the store. I've crawled in there. I found the compartment. I saw where he hid the radio. He listened to BBC in the Second World War. That was not allowed. So his best friend seemingly betrayed him. The Germans came in during the height of rush hour on a Saturday and grabbed both arms and marched him out, and we did not see him, hear from him at all for 6 months. 6 months. He was in two concentration camps in the south of Holland, one in Germany, and apparently when the Canadians, that's why we spent 25 years in Canada to say thank you, 25 years in the west and in the east, and when that section of Germany was liberated by the Canadians, some documents fell in his hands, seeming to indicate that he and his fellow Dutchmen were going to be executed in 2 weeks. And Canada liberated, put them on the train. When my mother met him at the train station in Groningen, she did not recognize him. He had gaunt, lost 55 pounds, and I was completely fascinated with the Tuftuf, the train. And so my dad got a cool reception, but he said to us, "No, with Germany and now Russia casting its shadow from the east, we're going to leave this country. We're going to leave." And it took about 18 months to get the documents and the inoculations and all, and find a sponsor. And we came to Michigan, Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I'm the only one in my family. My dad has 8 siblings. My mother has 4. They all grew up. They all died in Holland somewhere, all the way from the north to the south and so on. We're the only ones in Holland, so I don't have much of a family at all. And I was introduced to Kathy Sonke at the time, and I thought, she is a very attractive young lady. I am going to change her name. So I changed her name. She now carries my name, and she carried 4 of my children. We like to say that we have 4 children. They're all boys except 3. Okay? They're all boys except 3. 3 girls, and fathers and daughters have a special relationship. If you're a dad or a dad-to-be, boy, prize that relationship with your girl, because it takes a whole lot for her to stop caring for you and loving you and treating you as pretty special, which you are, of course. But it's great to have daughters. I have 3. All 4 are married. There's 9 grandchildren. And now when the grandchildren misbehave, it's wonderful. You just give them back. Your dad, your mom, over to you. Okay. One thing also that's special about the Groningen history and being my first 10 years as a Dutchman in the Netherlands, at the time when we had a football team, the total football, Johan Cruyff. I grew up in those years. You remember Johan Cruyff? But they beat Germany just recently, and the Dutch are coming up again. So I'm starting to wear orange again. But I learned when I was here, and I've carried this all my life, that there's a special text in Scripture for the Dutch. A special text for the Dutch. I don't know if you knew that, but it's Psalm 151 and verse 6. One person knows there's no Psalm 151. At least one person knows that. 151, verse 6, and there it says very clearly, if you can find that, is that the Lord forgiveth, he forgiveth our iniquities, for he knoweth that we are Dutch. Okay? That is, or at least it should be, in all of our Bibles. Okay, now where we moved to on the other side of the ocean, the far side, west side of the ocean, there's a great fascination. It's only developed and grown in the last four years perhaps. And that is an outfit called Ancestry.com, Ancestry.com. And I enjoy seeing this because it's not just straight advertising and sign on the dotted line, send your money, but it's a clever little story. It's a real person who tells me that he thought all his life he was German. I'm German, and I wear lederhosen, and I like sausage, and all the rest. And he said that I applied for Ancestry.com, and my heaviest part of the pie, the biggest slice, was actually Scottish. There's also Welsh and Dutch Irish in there. But basically, I was Scottish. So the pie, I looked at it, and I thought, I have to trade in my lederhosen for a kilt. And he did. No more lederhosen, and he started wearing a kilt. And very cheerful story, Ancestry.com. There's another woman who said that I discovered to my amazement that I was a Native American woman. I didn't know that. But 28% of me is that, and all the rest is less than 28, so I'm a Native American, and I can relate to the only persons who are not immigrants in America. Those are the Native tribes who came hundreds of years ago, some are from Asia, from Siberia. So amazing stories come out, and there's arousal of interest in my background, my past, the family, great-grandfathers, great-great-great-grandfathers, and trying to discover if there's somebody in my past who is well-known or famous, well-known, famous. He has made a great speech. He's written a great book. He's been a leader somewhere. If you find somebody who's been a crook or has served in jail sometime, you find enough leaves in the tree to cover him up, right? Just cover him with leaves. I don't recognize him. But America's trying to catch up a little bit with the Mormons. And the Mormons are really family oriented, family ancestry oriented folks, because heaven is all about family and connecting with those that are your brothers, sisters, cousins, and all the rest. We're all related, and it's important to, so in Salt Lake City, you know, they have the records back hundreds of years of the ancestry of the Mormons in the American West, mainly Salt Lake City and surroundings. But the Mormons are easily outdone by the Jews. Americans are they're catching on slowly. The Mormons have done this for years and years, but they have copied the Jews, who are very much ancestry-oriented, and the past really means something. If you know your father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and all the way back. And so the New Testament starts not with Mark, who wrote the first gospel. You would think Mark is the first gospel. He leads the parade after Malachi. No, it's Matthew, because Matthew starts with the genealogy of Jesus, and it goes all the way back to the father of the Jews, Abraham. And Luke says, I can go one better than that. In chapter 3, he says, actually, it goes all the way back to the Gentile, Adam. Not only the Jew, Abraham, Matthew 1, but the Gentile, Adam, all the way back to the beginning. He's the father of the Jews and the father of mankind. Jews, Matthew 1, and of all mankind, Luke 3. So Matthew and Luke together trace us all the way back to the beginning, part of the Jewish nation, their gift to the nations, and then all the other nations that started with the first man and his partner, Eve. And so I'm going to do something very unusual for the Christmas season. To start the Christmas season with a study of part of Jesus' family tree. And I hope this is a brand new experience for you, and that you will not say, boy, I'm glad that's over with. But we'll look at a family tree and some surprises, I think, some surprises in the family tree from Matthew 1. And let me read just the first six verses. Matthew 1 and the first six verses. A record of the genealogy, ancestry.com, of Jesus Christ, the son of David, son of Abraham, Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon. It's around this time that you might want to just poke your neighbor and wake him up. Now that's what genealogies do to us. Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Whose mother had been Uriah's wife. And we'll stop with the first six verses. But you see what Matthew does. Matthew was a publican or a tax collector. And as a tax collector, a Jew in Roman employ, very good with numbers. He's kind of obsessive compulsive with getting things in order, getting things right, and always straightening things out. If there were a bunch of papers lying on a desk, he would straighten them out and shuffle them, and they would be in order and organized and neat by the time Matthew had visited. That's the kind of a guy he was. But as a Jew, he worked for the Romans, so the Romans just used him, but the Jews didn't like him. But he puts together this family tree of Jesus in his gospel, the gospel according to Matthew. And it's very, very surprising that Matthew, in his good orderly way, not only puts together a genealogy, not with every single name mentioned, that would be too easy in a way, but he chooses three collections of 7 × 2, 14 names. There's three collections of 7 × 2, 14 names, so 42 names in all. And it goes all the way from Abraham to the height, King David. Then King David, the second set, goes all the way as low as Israel gets in the exile. But the exile, again, things change, and there's hope coming out of the ashes, and it all rises again to the great son of David, Jesus himself. So all the way up to David, and then David to the exile, and the exile back to the great son of David. And the interesting thing about Matthew's work, so it's 7 doubled, 14 times 14, or plus 14, plus 14, you get 42 in the family tree. It's well organized. He knew what he was doing. There's no whoops in this family tree at all. Oh, forgot that. Missed out on that one. That's not Matthew. So what he could have done if he had to is include some women, as we'll see just a little bit later. That was not the norm, to include women in your family tree. It is today for the Jews. Are you a genuine Jew? Well, you check the matriarchal line. Is my mother back there somewhere? Is she a Jew? And that'll give me status to go home to Israel, and I'll be one of them. And it'll be now one of us, because it's through the mother. But in the time the genealogy is written, oh no. And I would argue that if you examined the billfolds of any decent Jew, any good Jew in the first century, and you looked in and saw the pictures of the family, there's the wife and there's the two kids, and Joshua and Jochebed, and it was all wonderful. But then there'd be four other pictures of the great heroines of Jewish history and of the Old Testament. And pictures would be there of Eve and Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel. Four winners in every first century Jewish wallet. Eve, Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, and all four are missing in Matthew. They're all missing in Matthew. And what he does is he slips in there instead Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba. She's not even named. She's the wife of Uriah. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah, or Bathsheba. Those are the four that Matthew chooses instead of choosing the four in Jewish wallets. And the one that daddy would show his daughter, because all over first century Cana and Capernaum and Jerusalem and Samaria, and all they're all little Eves and Sarahs and Rebeccas and Rachels running around. Nobody called their daughter Tamar. Nobody called their daughter Rahab. So what in the world is Matthew up to? This is the first surprise in this great family tree in the first chapter in the New Testament. So let's look at the first one. I'm not going to read all the stories, but I'll read a bit longer from Tamar because she's the least familiar. You can tell me about Rahab. You can tell me a lot about Ruth. You can probably tell me about Bathsheba. You probably know less about Tamar than the others. So we'll read just a little bit more about Tamar. But here's part of Tamar's story. And it's in Genesis 38. And just to continue the same theme, by the way, it continues the same theme exactly, that Tamar and her story with her father-in-law, who's Judah, Tamar and Judah, occupy Genesis 38. And in Genesis 37 and 39, you have the good guy, Joseph. The good guy, Joseph. And you scour the whole story of Joseph. And what did he do wrong? Very little. Very little. And probably in a lot of first century homes, why don't you be more like Joseph? Why don't you be more like Joseph? Why don't you speak the way he, why don't you do what Joseph did? Now, you're an embarrassment to your father sometimes. Be more like Joseph. Read his story. Joseph was a star. But between 37 and 39, you have a Judah who gets into all kinds of trouble with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. And later on, it's interesting that when you look at Jesus' tree, he's the descendant not of Joseph, but of Judah. Already we're beginning to gather our clues, right? He's the descendant of Judah, not of Joseph. Interesting. So let's pick up a little bit of the story. Judah, his son married Tamar. Tamar was a Hittite, and got a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Ur, the firstborn, was wicked in God's sight, so God put him to death. Then the second son is also put to death, Onan. He said, the kid is not going to be mine. So in Old Testament language, he spilled his seed on the ground. He did not fulfill his obligation. And he's killed for his impertinence by God as well. And Joseph said, wait for my third one. Wait for my third one. When he grows up, you can marry him. And he forgot. He forgot. Son number one died. Son number two died. But now son number three is waiting and waiting, and she's waiting. She said, my father-in-law is not keeping his promise. So off he goes to a sheep-shearing feast. And Tamar is clever. She took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, sat down in the entrance to Eniam, a small village, on the road to Timnah. For she saw that although Shelah had now grown up, she had not been given to him as his wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and said, come now, let me sleep with you. And what will you give me to sleep with you? She asked. Verse 17, Genesis 38, I'll send you a young goat for my flock, he said. Will you give me something as a pledge until you send it? She said. He said, what pledge should I give you? Well, your seal and the cord and the staff in your hand. It's a clever young lady. She answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. After she left, she took off her veil, put on her widow's clothes again. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the man, where's the shrine prostitute who is here beside the road at Eniam? There hasn't been any shrine prostitute here, they said. So he went back to Judah and said, I didn't find her. Besides, the men who live there said, there hasn't been any prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep what she has, or we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but I didn't find her. About 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant. Judas said, bring her out and have her burned to death. These stories get weirder, I'll tell you. Bring her out and have her put to death. As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. I am pregnant by the man who owns these, she said. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. And Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I would not give her to my son Shelah. And he did not sleep with her again. And then the little story follows about she bears twins. And the first twin comes out, and the second twin muscles his way past the first twin. The first twin, the hand comes out. A red cord is put around the hand. Then he retreats because his brother is muscling past him. And Perez is born first. And as often happens in Genesis, God has a favoritism for number two, not number one. Not Cain, but Abel. Not Esau, but Jacob. And on, he prefers number two to destroy this thing that number one gets all the goodies. He's the first and he's the prize of his father's eye. He gets the special treatment. And God has an affection for number two. So Perez is number two. He didn't have the cord on his hand, but he becomes the man in Jesus' family tree. And his mother is named by Matthew. The Hittite prostitute who hoodwinked her father-in-law into sleeping with her and said, whoever owns these things that I got, this is the father of my child, or now in case my children, my twins. And Judah looked and said, she's more righteous than I. That was a very valid judgment. That's the story of Tamar, a Hittite, a prostitute, and a clever young lady whose son and she herself find their names in the first family tree of the New Testament in Matthew 1. The second lady that makes an appearance is Rahab, of course, Tamar, and then Rahab. And Rahab's story, I'm sure you know. She lives in a house on the walls of Jericho. She's on the walls of Jericho, and it's clearly known by all as a house of prostitution. They would probably say the version in 1200 BC, they would say, before we check in with the king in Jericho, let's visit the red light districts in Jericho. Let's visit the red light district. And people know where that is in Amsterdam, right? It's not scattered out all over the place. You can get sex anywhere in Amsterdam. You go to the red light district. That's where you go. And the women are in the windows with little to the left of the imagination. And come in and I'll give you an enjoyable evening. And we happened to walk past that place, not too far away from the University of Groningen. There's a street like that where women are on display in the windows. I thought, oh no, Groningen too. That was two or three visits ago. Groningen too. But the red light district, Jericho had one. And that house, but Rahab, the Canaanite, welcomed the spies, said, I'll hide you, hide under the flax. The king is not going to get you. He closed the gate. Another red cord. This is all very interesting. Another red cord is hung outside the house and the city walls. And the spies hide for 3 days and they escape. They tell the story to Joshua when he gets back. And when the city is destroyed, only one little piece of wall with Rahab and her entire family are spared. And they're left there in order to be celebrated in Matthew's family tree. Rahab, the father, or the mother of the chap that is named there in verse 4 of Matthew 1. So you get Rahab. The one that is somewhat problematic is that if there's a good person among the four, probably most of us would say Ruth. Among Christian churches that I've visited, a lot of Christian churches, or in student work, we've been with InterVarsity student work for many, many years, and I got to meet a lot of Ruths. Now, my boss in Montreal for 16 years was someone called Ruth. Ruth. And Ruth had a cat that she loved, and the cat's name was Boaz. Ruth, a single young lady, and Boaz, her cat. Now, you can name your daughter Ruth. That's okay. You don't name her Tamar. You don't name her Rahab. You don't name her Bathsheba. I've met very few Bathshebas, very few Tamars, very few Rahabs, but Ruth is okay. But I'm here to tell you that it's not okay. It's not okay. Ruth gets a wonderful name, which is, in some ways, it is misplaced. Because the story in chapter 3, read it again. The story in chapter 3, the mother-in-law, Naomi, she advises that Ruth go to the threshing floor where Boaz is. The men are threshing all day long the barley fields, and they're just exhausted, and they go to sleep with a little bit of grain to provide a cushion, and they go to sleep there, and they're ready for another day, another long day of work. And she says, well, go to the place where he is and uncover his feet. He'll be shocked. You know, uncover his feet. He'll be shocked, but he'll get into a conversation, and that conversation will be the beginning to a relationship that might work out good for you. So Naomi had too much time to come up with this scheme. But I thought yesterday, now what illustration can I use to say uncovering the feet is a cultural slice of the century in which Boaz and Ruth lived that is difficult for us to understand. It's a little foreign to us. But let me give you, at some risk, a very similar emotional event that would help you catch what's going on in Ruth 3. And that is, if in a group like this, during a Sunday morning service, you notice that there's a young man and a young woman, both university students. 80% of you are university students. There's two university students, and they've had an eye for each other. And he's had a good long first look, and that has earned a second look, and some time together and attending plays together and going for long walks when the weather's decent in Groningen together. And then you notice in church one morning, they're sitting together and his arm is around her, and his arm is around her, and there's a preacher that morning, completely unlike me. This one is dull. He's boring. Right? He's dull. He's boring. And he has to say the same thing over and over again. And people are getting very, very restless and just wish he could find the amen. So you watch this couple, and as you're watching the two of them, his hand is starting to play with the little latch at the top of her zipper on her dress. And he slowly lowers the zipper an inch, 6 inches, until it's all the way down to her belt level. And the zipper comes all the way down. And you pay attention to the preacher, but it's more like this. What's he going to do next? How far is he going to go? How far is he going to go? But the zipper comes down, and it can only go so far, as you know. But what is he doing? What's going on here? And it's not good. And you say, I hope somebody talks to him after the service. It's not me. But I hope somebody talks to him after the service. This is not right. This is not the way you behave in church. Well, when Ruth is living, that's not the way you behave with men on a threshing floor when the harvest is going on, and you sneak into a place where the man, the head of the threshing floor, is there working, and he's absolutely tired, and you go and you lie next to him, and you take the blankets and uncover his feet. For Dutchmen, for Americans, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but try some time to visit with Chinese friends and take off your shoes and your socks and let them see the bottom of your feet. A social error of great proportion. You do not expose your feet in a Chinese audience. You keep your shoes and your socks on and you don't show them the bottom of your feet. Never. And the Dutch probably have little cultural touches like that, what you do and what you really don't do. So Ruth in chapter 3, that's a no-no. That's a no-no. So I'm sure that future parents should be a little bit more careful and probably say, no, let's skip Ruth this year. Let's make her marry or something safe. The interesting thing about the fourth girl is that she's named Bathsheba in 1 Samuel 11 and 12. Yes, 1 Samuel 11 and 12. But even in the genealogy, Matthew 1 and verse 6, Matthew 1, 6, she becomes the wife of Uriah. And she's named the wife of Uriah three times in 2 Samuel. So dare not say Bathsheba, but just to remind you, she belongs to somebody else. She belongs to somebody else. And David should have been with his men going across the Jordan, Ramoth Gilead, and being involved in the war, because in the springtime, and the when the mud is no longer sloshy, but it hardens, and you can get your chariots and your horses across solid ground, that's when the time the people go to war. And David says, not this time. Not this time. He sends Joab across, and he starts wandering on his roof, and he notices everything out in the roof. And it's his mistake. He wants what doesn't belong to him. But I think Bathsheba is also a little bit to blame, because who takes off all her clothes and bathes outside so the king on a higher level can spot her and quickly instruct a servant to get the binocular so he can get a better look? So she's to blame as well. It always takes two to play, right? It always takes two to play. So David and he called her in. They had slept together, of course. They sleep together in the Bible once, and she gets pregnant. She gets pregnant, and he says, how am I going to cover this? He invites Uriah home. Uriah sleeps outside the gate in the cold and the dark. He says, go home. Enjoy your wife. You're a special soldier of mine. You're one of my top 30 generals, one of the top 30. Second night, go home to your wife. No, so he could cover it that Uriah would have sex with his wife, and it would be Uriah's child, not David's child. And for 1 year, David keeps that secret for 1 year. But Bathsheba does not belong to you. He made a very serious, serious mistake. And it had to be Nathan with a clever story who said, well, this man deserves to die. Actually, king, it's you. That was a very effective parable. So, four women. Four women. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and the wife of Uriah, or Bathsheba. And they're all in Jesus' family tree. And it also struck me, did you notice it all? I hope you did, that Matthew, as a publican, he's a Jew in Roman employ, right? A Jew in Roman employ. And Rome would say, no, from Capernaum in the next month, we need to see 100,000 shekels. If you can get more than 100,000, that's up to you. That's free, and you can build a wing on your house, upgrade your wardrobe, whatever you want to do. Get all the money you can. We just want 100,000 exactly sent to Antioch every year, and they'll send it on to Rome, and we'll check to see if you're doing your job. And so the Jews hated him. One result is that he is absolutely wealthy. I saw a picture of Matthew in a museum in Bruges last week, Bruges in northwest Belgium. And there was, in all his finery, alone on his side of the table, was Matthew. Great boy, what an outfit. And all the other people waiting to pay their taxes, and in the corner, almost disappearing out of the corner, was a man with a beard and a kindly smile, looking over his shoulder and saying, come, Matthew, follow me. And Matthew is struck, and he's caught. Whatever he's offering is better than the life I'm offering now, because what I have now is I go home, and I have one plate and one knife and one fork and one spoon and one glass and one remote for my television set, and the only voices I ever hear are the folks talking on the television, but I have no friends. And Jesus can open up friendship for me with other publicans that he knows. And so Matthew, if I were in his shoes, I would say, I'm going to get on the Jews' good side. I'm a Jew now. They accept me. I'm following Jesus. They think a little bit better of me than they did before. And what I'll do is I'll write Eve and Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel into the family tree, and that'll get me several points with the Jews that I want to impress. Put their four heroines in the family tree. But Matthew, of all people, he dares to put four losers in the tree. He doesn't put their four winners in the tree. He puts four losers in the family tree. He's that secure about his new reputation that he's willing to suffer misunderstanding and shame to say, you're putting them in the family tree? Because you see, he made not one, not two, but three mistakes. Three mistakes. Number one, he put women in a family tree, which was the province of men, good men, and only men. Among the Jews, sadly, among too many Americans, maybe too many Dutch, that's still true, that we have men and we want to be men who are called women. And there's not this equality. And Pierre Trudeau, or Justin Trudeau from Canada, where I lived for 25 years, said, you know, part of my life is to be a true feminist and help them to achieve what they're able to get the same rewards for the same kind of work and amount of work. And I'm a true feminist in that way. So is Jesus. In their best sense of the word, he was a feminist. And four women in the family tree. Four women in the family tree. Did you know that a good Pharisee would fall by the side of his bed, knees on the floor, folded hands on the bed, and he would pray every night, "Oh Lord, I thank you for not creating me a Gentile or a woman. I thank you for not creating me a Gentile or a woman." Pharisee prayer every night. So Matthew chooses women. Secondly, he chooses women that are not Jews. If you can make a family tree, you put a Hittite in there, you put a Canaanite in there, you put a Moabite in there, you slip in another Hittite. Uriah was a Hittite, and so was his wife Bathsheba. So there's a Hittite, a Canaanite, a Moabite, and another Hittite. All non-Jews in the family tree. And worst of all, so by the stretch of imagination, a Jew would say, well, putting women in, okay. Putting women in that are Gentiles, well, we'll allow that. We'll allow that to slip while the censor is not looking. We'll allow that to slip in if they're exceptional women who have done a lot of good, who have fed the hungry, who have been kind to women who have lost their reputation for careless sex, and women who are kind and who write well and speak well and lead with gentleness and firmness. If there's an exceptional woman, if she finds her way in the family tree, well, maybe we can kind of wink a little bit and allow that to slip past. A decent woman, a good woman. But no, all of them have sexual carelessness and sexual looseness and sexual morals that an Eve and Sarah and their friends would not share. They would say in their more judgmental moments, no, honey, Abigail, or whatever her name was, don't be like Tamar. Don't be like Rahab, etc., etc. So, number one, they're women. Number two, they're Gentile women. Number three, they're Gentile women with somewhat muddy and problematic relationships. Now, where this story ends is that, and it took me a long while to come to this, and I hope it doesn't take you nearly as long, but Jesus said, in my family tree, I don't want to hide anyone with leaves or make sure they're on the backside of the tree where they're harder to notice, you know, on the back of the tree, or find somebody to get out of the tree, to leave the tree for decent people, hardworking people, contributing people, people with good reputations. No, he said, I'll fill my tree with losers. Then I'll spend much of a lifetime in making these losers into winners. And they know that I've made them into winners, and they'll say, Lord, thank you. The tree's designed not for winners, but for losers. And it took me a long time, but one day I realized that because Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and the wife of Bathsheba are in the tree, there's hope for me. And perhaps there's hope for you. Because the Lord's Supper is coming up, and believe me, the Lord's Supper is not for winners, it's for losers. The Lord's Supper is for losers. You don't say, well, I've had a good meal and a little bit of dessert wouldn't hurt, I suppose. The Lord's Supper is my dessert, a little bit of bread, a little bit of wine. No, you come to the meal because you're empty, you're hungry. And without that constant reminder of the food that God provides, hey, I will die. So what we're going to celebrate together and experience together is very similar to what Matthew tried to get through, that he came for losers. If he came for losers, he came. He came for us. That's a pretty darn good Christmas message.